From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. As Baltimore's police brainstorm how to stop the surge in violence, we speak with Delegate Jill Carter about trust between the community and the police, the rights of police officers, and whether the state legislature can address Baltimore's problems. Then Tom Hall talks to local theater artists cooperating in a series of plays called Parody Fest, all by women and transgender playwrights. Plus, each summer in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, the Contemporary American Theater Festival produces cutting-edge new plays. Our theater critic, Jaywin Russick, brings us a roundup, including a play about the Russian punk band Pussy Riot. And we meet a teaching artist and two student apprentices creating a mural in West Baltimore. For 80 kids, the city's Art at Work Sandtown project means a summer job and much more. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The numbers capture only part of the pain of the crime surge in Baltimore, but they are sobering. Twice as many shootings as this time last year. Homicides up by 50%. As the Baltimore Sun reports this morning, 171 people murdered in the city this year, 27 of them this month. Interim Police Commissioner Kevin Davis is asking the rank and file for suggestions about how to reorganize the department. We'd planned to discuss the spurt in crime with Interim Commissioner Davis this morning. With everything else going on, he sent word he could not join us. I'm pleased to be here with Delegate Jill P. Carter, who represents North and West Baltimore District 41. She has served on the Judiciary Committee since she was elected to the House in 2002, and she's been outspoken on criminal justice issues. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Baltimore.
Yes.
Went to Western High School, Loyola College, University of Baltimore Law School. In your view, did policing in the city used to work better than it is now?
It appeared so. I know that there was, first of all, I think that there was a belief that even in every community, in where I grew up in Ashburton certainly, that police officers were there to serve and protect. And while there may be some instances of disparate treatment, some instances of brutality, that those were not the norm, that that was not the culture of policing. But I believe that in many communities throughout the city, especially many of the Black communities, many of the more impoverished communities, that is the culture that has grown up over the last couple of decades.
And to what do you attribute it?
Well, everything is about leadership and policy. But from my vantage point as a legislator, I've really observed the almost omnipotent power of the police lobby, the police unions, and the police agencies. They have a tremendous amount of power over legislative leadership, almost as if they've been allowed to kind of dictate the policies, as opposed to legislators and political leaders taking control and governing what policies will be allowed to exist. I think that is a part of the problem, the tremendous power and the resistance to change and grapple with modern-day issues, issues in 2015, issues that gave rise to the problem that we had with the problems in the community that gave rise to the uprising in the wake of Freddie Gray.
What would you say is the biggest issue that you hear in the community about policing?
Well, the biggest issue is the lack of police and community relationship. And we hear it, and it almost begins to sound trite, but it is not. Even recently, with the new interim commissioner and the announcing of a war room, that is, once again, this policy that has failed for a number of years, this policy or belief process that we will somehow go after the bad guys without having a relationship with the community first in order to do that, in order to weed out the bad from the good. So I think that there's always an absence at the table of decision-making of the community, of leaders in the community that are able to better steer the direction of the police and able to form a relationship so that they can have a relationship with the community, so they can find out what's going on and be in a position sometimes to prevent crime.
I'd like to listen together to a brief part of the conversation that Interim Commissioner Davis had with Dan Rodericks on Midday a week ago, because it kind of gets to this point.
Pastor once told me that the community won't trust its police department until the community knows its police department respects them. So what we set about doing in Prince George's County is gaining the respect, or ensuring the community knows that we respect them, and then they trust us and give us information. The Crime Stoppers program in Baltimore is certainly an effective one, but we can do more with it. Most of the calls we get into Crime Stoppers have to do with the distribution and sale of narcotics, and that's important for us to know about, but we get very little information about violent crimes. Most of our murders in Baltimore City are daytime murders. 70% of our murders in the city happen outdoors. So we know we have witnesses, but we need to do more to encourage people to partner with us.
Do you, Delegate Carter, do you think he's on the right track in that thinking?
Well, it sounds good, and it's on the right track with the thinking, but the problem is so grave that it's going to take an all hands on deck approach, as they say, and that includes collaboration with the community. It includes collaboration with Black officers in the department that have spoken out also about discrimination within the department. And I think that the right idea is, you know, and I've said many times, you can't serve and protect those whom you don't respect. But even beyond that, because we have so many officers that are not familiar with the culture, the community here, that even if they don't fundamentally respect them, they need to be trained in such a way to treat them with respect. Do you know what I mean? So it comes from, the solutions are holistic. It's not one thing. It's not just foot patrols. It's not this... You have to change the philosophy top down, bottom up. And the holistic approach involves growing up young boys and girls into men and women that want to protect and serve and want to serve on the police department and the communities that they are reared. It involves training and changing the philosophy of training from an us against them idea to, a form of community style protecting and serving. And then I think finally, when we talk about the fact that the philosophy is kind of upside down, that there's been a lot of money recently spent in riot gear and not money put into community building community relations, and that's the reverse of what should happen. But I do think that the new commissioner, interim commissioner, sounds that he is fully engaged in fixing these problems, but he can't fix them alone, and he can't fix them with an old way of thinking about policing.
That's Baltimore City Delegate Jill P. Carter here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cass. Delegate Carter serves on the House Judiciary Committee and has been outspoken about policing issues. You mentioned growing, you wish Baltimore grew police commissioners, I'm sorry, police officers in the city. That I've heard statistics that that's something like 9 out of 10 officers commute into the city. Should the city require that city residents should city residents be required of police officers? Is that something the city could do? And if it could, should it?
The city has resisted that idea under claims that it's unconstitutional to have a residency requirement, but I personally disagree with that. I believe that there's always a balancing test, and if you can show that there's a compelling need to have officers live in the city, and certainly I believe we could show that we could. And I think a residency requirement for the command staff as well as the rank and file, and there is a way to do that. You can't just start and say immediately today, if you don't live in the city, you're out. But, you know, over a certain number of years, anyone that wants to serve in the police department must acquire residency within Baltimore City, and that should be just a part of a requirement of the job.
Would that be something the city could require, or would that require state legislation?
I believe that the city is in the best position to make that happen. I think it could be somewhat of a hybrid, because the Baltimore Police Department is technically a state agency. And so to that extent, the state legislature has control, some governance control over them. But I do believe that it's a policy that the mayor and city council could implement and possibly go to the state legislature for, I guess, the solidifying of the policy. I believe that could happen.
We just passed the 2-year anniversary this past Saturday of the death of Tyrone West, who was 44 in 2013, a black man who died in a struggle while police were arresting him after a traffic stop. His family, Tyrone West's family, asked you to organize a presentation to the Department of Justice a week ago. What was the purpose of that?
Well, first, let me just give acknowledgement to the fact that before Freddie Gray, the Tyrone West family were really the leading force of protest in the city, most consistent after the death, the brutal murder of Tyrone West. But the issue is that there are so many hundreds, if not thousands, of people that have stories of brutality, stories of mistreatment, stories about their loved ones being killed at the hands of law enforcement officers, that it was the thought of Tawanda Jones, who's Tyrone West's very outspoken sister, that they should be able to air these concerns in a public forum rather than just have everyone have individual private interviews with the Department of Justice, that this is such a huge issue that encompasses so many people and families that we should be coming together to give each other support.
Of course, the Department of Justice is investigating Baltimore's police department. There's also on a different track, a task force, a legislative task force that the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House set up after this past session of the legislature. It was announced shortly after the events following Freddie Gray's death. What do you expect to come of either of these efforts?
I expect very little substantive change or meaningful legislative reform. I believe that the task force was put together to sort of keep the status quo in place, but give the community something, some minor appeasement so that they can contend that we've done something to fix this problem. And I just want to point out that there was ample opportunity over the last several legislative sessions, but particularly last session, there were close to 20 bills on police accountability that the legislature categorically rejected. And these bills were sponsored by a number of different various legislators. I was a main legislator sponsoring most of the legislation, but many of them. And these pieces of legislation were categorically rejected. And many of the proponents of these bills are not made part of this task force. So I believe it is a total effort to keep the status quo, resist change, but sort of a CYA effort in the wake of Freddie Gray. And that's not to say nothing will come of it, but the level of reform is not likely to happen with this group. And let me just briefly...
We're out of time. Okay. Can you do it in 10 seconds?
Yes. The Legislative Black Caucus is forming its own work group to try to do a better job or assist, I suppose, this group.
Okay. We will keep in touch with you about that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Delegate Jill P. Carter represents North and West Baltimore and serves on the Judiciary Committee. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us after the news. Plays that make you think here on 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
And good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. This morning, a look at the vibrant theater scene here in the Baltimore region. Coming up in a bit, Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins us for her weekly theater review. This week, she takes a look at the new plays being presented at the Contemporary American Theater Festival in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. Now, of the 5 plays being presented there this season, 3 are by women. It's rare for women playwrights to represent the majority of a festival or even most of a typical season of plays at many American theater companies. Now, a conversation about local theater companies who are cooperating to present a bunch of plays this month and next, which are all written by women and transgender playwrights. Plays are taken from a list compiled by a collective in Los Angeles called the Kilroys. My guests this morning are part of the team at the Cohesion Theater Company in Baltimore, which is presenting this festival. It's called Parody Fest. Alicia Stanley is the director of Parody Fest, and Jessica Kim is the readings coordinator and curator. Good morning to you both. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Alicia, let me start with you. The point of this festival is to address the lack of parity between men and women playwrights represented across the spectrum of theaters. Tell us about the Kilroys and how they're approaching that problem.
Sure. The Kilroys are an LA-based organization of women who decided that, or who really wanted to answer the question of whether there are good plays being written now by female playwrights. It's common to hear from artistic directors and theater makers who program seasons that they'd love to produce more plays by women, they just don't know of any good ones. And of course, that's ridiculous. New works are being written all the time by women. So they amassed an organization, you know, a kind of nationwide volunteer base of theater makers, dramaturgs, professors, you know, every aspect of theater, to recommend new works that they had seen or read that were written by female and transgender playwrights. And there were 755 nominations this year. The final list is 53 top recommended plays. Yeah.
So these are suggestions given to the Kilroys by people from all over the country. Do you really think that's true, that people who are running theater companies say, oh, gee, we'd love to do plays by women, but there just aren't any? That seems kind of anachronistic to me. I mean, that just seems like silly. is that really what's going on in the theater scene?
Yeah, that's often the case. And if you look at the percentage of plays written by female or male playwrights, it's hovering at about 24% female in any given season.
Yeah, interesting. And so, Jessica, of these 53 plays that the Kilroys have put on their list, you all are coordinating performances of 44 of them. So how do you choose the plays that you're going to do, and how do you match them up with the various companies?
So we have the list of all the plays, the 53 plays, as well as a backup list of about 15 from the 2014 Kilroy's list. And I have a wonderful reading team, and I send out a script to them, and they go ahead and analyze it and do a character breakdown, a genre, a rating for maturity, a synopsis, and then a little bit about the author. And so I send out this synopsis document to all the directors in this festival, the Parody Fest, and they'll email back what they want. And it is a first come, first serve kind of thing, so we do have some conflicts so far, but for the most part, it's working out, and people are really genuinely excited about what they're picking.
So it's been the case that two or three companies might all want to do the same one.
Yes.
But then you've got to negotiate that.
Yeah, and that can be a little bit tricky because obviously I want someone to really be passionate about their piece, but it seems to be working out pretty well.
How many different theater companies are actually involved when the dust settles?
I think we have about
20.
Yeah, 20.
Terrific. And these are staged readings. What does that mean?
So a staged reading is the actors have the scripts in hand, and they can either, you know, have music stands and just kind of engage in character and mannerisms and interact with each other via that way. Or Alicia here directed at Artscape yesterday, and hers was more of a more staged, so the actors can move around with their scripts, and there can be lighting and props and sound effects, and it can almost be like a production, and the actors just happen to have scripts in their hand, and it's pretty awesome.
So there's sort of various levels of rehearsal and preparation prior to presenting these?
Yes, exactly. We wanted to make it as easy as possible on theater companies to participate in the festival, especially it being the first year. So it pretty much ranges all the way from, you know, actors stand at music stands and read from their scripts and someone reads the stage directions, all the way to including technical elements. We had props and lights and everything at Theater Project yesterday.
So it's a six-week festival. You've just finished the third week, so you're halfway through. How's the reception been so far?
It's been great. Yeah, we've had fairly good audiences. Our opening night celebration was fantastic, and companies have really been enjoying the scripts. We've had a lot of great feedback from directors that they would potentially be interested in producing this script fully at some point, which is a major goal of the festival to get these produced.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, is there a danger because these are just readings and they're going to be subject to, you know, in some cases, a minimal amount of rehearsal and preparation? Is it a danger that some of these people's work will be presented in a less than ideal fashion? I mean, could it turn people off to some of the work if it's not, you know, if they're not seeing it in a fully produced way?
That is possible. We haven't experienced that being the case. A lot of the time when we get together to read it just very minimally with audiences, we're able to see the potential of what the production could be. And often we'll have talkbacks and things afterwards. So mm-hmm. if there's something that, you know, some of the scripts are kind of surreal or don't have a clear meaning. And so we'll have talkbacks afterwards to kind of discuss the script, how it might look in a production, how certain things might be conveyed.
Because Jessica, if you're a theater artist, you're used to reading plays, and I suppose this is one step up from that. I mean, mm-hmm. hearing it voiced by, you know, actors, and
right.
you know, it's better than just reading it yourself.
Yeah.
I have a number of friends who, I'm a musician in my other life. I conduct a chorus and orchestra called the Choral Arts Society, and I have a lot of friends who are women composers. You know, so they're writing contemporary music, and I'm playing their music all the time, and to a person, not one of them wants to be known as a woman composer because they just don't want that pigeonhole. They don't want that stamp. They're composers like everybody else. What's the feeling about that for the playwrights that you're working with? I mean, are they happy to be, you know, sequestered in this group of women playwrights, or, you know, do they bristle at that notion?
It's actually curious you brought that up, because we had a panel discussion yesterday, a Women in Science panel. And there was a composer in the audience, a lady composer, and she brought up her grievances about male coworkers that she works with who have these like subtle ways of kind of deriding her, I guess, because she's not a male composer and it's kind of a male-dominated field. So I think that the female playwrights in our festival mostly just seem so excited to get their work out because they're emerging artists. This might be their first or second production that's kind of hitting it big, you know? So I feel like a lot of them have very positive response, and none of them have expressed any concern because they're a female playwright. And I think that this festival is about bringing equality, where it doesn't matter if the playwright is a male or a female when you're introducing a play to a director. It's just the quality of the work itself, you mm-hmm. know?
Mm-hmm. And Alicia Stanley, this past season, Center Stage presented two plays by Amy Herzog, and they mm-hmm. called it the Amy Herzog Festival. It was a mini festival, two plays. We have a theater company here in town that's part of this parody fest, Strand Theater, which concentrates on work by women. My daughter happens to be a playwright. She's at the Yale School of Drama, and it's interesting that in her cohort of nine people, three of them are men, six of them are women at the moment. I wonder, do you think that strides are being made towards more parity? There's a festival coming up in Washington, the Women's Voices Theater Festival, which will feature works by more than 50 women starting next month and running through November. It seems to me a lot of movement towards parity. What's your sense of it?
I agree. I think strides absolutely are being made, and you know, that percentage of plays in a season written by female playwrights is definitely creeping up. And hopefully with things like Parody Fest and the Women's Voices Festival in D.C., it'll affect main stage seasons for longer, for years to come,
mm-hmm.
right? So we have this dedicated time that we're specifically going to look at plays by female playwrights, and hopefully that will have a long-term effect in the ways that people's seasons look.
Sure. I guess this, in a way, this is kind of one-stop shopping, Jessica Kim. I mean, if a theater director is looking for plays by women, you know, you go to the Kilroy's website, there's those 53 plays, there's information about how to get the scripts, and of course now they can have the experience of the plays that have been done here. This is the first year of the festival. You have plans to continue doing this in out years?
I actually joined Peace Corps, so I'll be in South America next summer. But Alicia, I think, does indeed plan to continue this festival.
Yes, the response from the theater community and from audiences has been very positive. So in all likelihood, this will not be a one-time event.
Good. I mean, at its core, what's the reason for the lack of parity in theater companies? Is it just that it's a male-dominated business, that most of the theater directors and general managers are men?
I think that's a huge problem, that a lot of the people planning the seasons are men, and then women's works just aren't treated the same way. They aren't taken as seriously. Even looking back in the 20th century, you know, you can name a dozen male playwrights that are considered classics, but you know, women were also writing.
Yeah.
They just don't get the recognition. Yeah.
Well, you guys are doing something to address that. All right. Well, thanks both of you for coming in and break a leg with the rest of the festival. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alicia Stanley and Jessica Kim are part of the team at the Cohesion Theater Company, which is producing Parody Fest. It's a festival of plays by women and transgender playwrights. It continues this week with plays produced by the EMP Collective, the Cohesion Theater Company, Interrobang Theater, UMBC Girl Parts, the Spotlighters Theater, and the Baltimore Improv Group. When the dust settles, there will have been 44 stage readings of plays at many different companies around town. The festival runs until August 9th. We've got a complete schedule and links to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. More on the new theater scene coming right up. For her weekly theater review this morning, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has traveled to Shepherdstown, West Virginia, for what has become one of the most important festivals of new American plays. Here's her take.
The Contemporary American Theater Festival turned silver this summer. For a quarter century, it has brought fresh off the page, top-notch new plays to sophisticated audiences that make the annual pilgrimage to the unlikely mecca of Shepherdstown, West Virginia. The five plays in this season's bold lineup have settings that span the globe, from Johns Hopkins Hospital to a Moscow courtroom and prison. Though producing director Ed Herendine says he doesn't look for plays with a common theme, most of this season's offerings feature characters struggling with psychological problems, from clinical disorders to brainwashing. The two characters in Jonna Adams' World Builders are participants in a Hopkins drug trial to treat schizoid personality disorder. Whitney and Max are both ensconced in their own fantasy worlds. Hers, complex and futuristic. His, narrow, frightening, and immediate. Max has no interest in connecting with real people. But World Builders is subtitled A Love Story. And in the course of the play, Max and Whitney form a bond. Part of that bond is their collaboration on a manifesto that Whitney writes to convince the doctors not to medicate their worlds out of existence.
We are trying to change people's opinions, specifically our psychiatrists' opinions on schizoid personality disorder and about the positive possibilities in the condition, and we have to attack all the negative assumptions.
Brenna Peluggi and Chris Thorne deliver tour de force performances in roles that require them to convey as much by staring off into space as they do through dialogue. This challenge begins as soon as we enter the theater and find Peluggi and Thorne already on stage, engrossed in their separate worlds. Like Jonna Adams' 2012 festival hit Gideon's Knot, World Builders is deeply troubling. But the final scene in World Builders is more open-ended, and the result even more engrossing. Stephen Dietz's On Clover Road is billed as a thriller, and you get a chill down your spine as soon as you see designer David M. Barber's derelict motel room set. Nothing good can happen in this place, despite the good intentions of the protagonist. Kate is the single mother of a teenage daughter who joined a cult 4 years ago. Tasha Lawrence brings aching familiarity to the role of Kate. She's a mother ready to go to any length to get her daughter back, including hiring the antagonistic deprogrammer played by Lee Sellers.
These questions, these are the kind of things you're going to ask Jesse?
I might not. It's not helpful, really, for you to know the questions I'm going to ask your daughter.
But look, I'm only
I have done this, Mrs. Hunter. Would you like to listen to me now? How about that? How about you listen to me? And now your feelings are hurt. You'll come to thank me for that. We can be much more effective as a team if you hate my guts.
Then I think we're going to be great.
The play twists and turns and twists and turns and twists and turns some more. A few twists need honing. But On Clover Road does what thrillers should do. It keeps you on the edge of your seat. Then playwright Dietz does something rare for this genre. He leaves you guessing how things will turn out. And that may be the most tantalizing twist of all. The Contemporary American Theater Festival steps into new territory with We Are Pussy Riot, a play it commissioned. The show is the most audience interactive, in-your-face work I can remember seeing here. The style fits the subject perfectly. Pussy Riot is a real-life Russian activist punk band. Three of its members were arrested, tried, and jailed in 2012 after a protest at a Moscow cathedral. Essentially, this all-female group is a performance art collective, and much of Barbara Hammond's play is presented as a piece of performance art. This begins in the lobby, where Pussy Riot reenacts a protest, complete with their colorful trademark ski masks. Later, in flashback, we hear how they prepare.
We're not frightened at all. If they say, take off your mask.
Don't be scared.
If they say,
what's your name?
Don't be stupid. Make it up.
Put some chocolate in your bag.
In case you spend the night in jail. You cannot suppress our thoughts. You cannot take our freedom.
The play consists primarily of Pussy Riot's 2012 trial. Theatergoers serve as courtroom spectators. A few are even called up as witnesses. Playwright Hammond constructed her script largely from trial transcripts, letters, and public statements. She also incorporates a character based on a male political prisoner who went on a 2-month hunger strike while awaiting trial in prison. Members of Pussy Riot have protested such cases, but splitting the play's focus proves distracting and a bit confusing. The judge claims the Pussy Riot defendants have a personality disorder. But the broad, absurdist manner in which the trial is portrayed leaves no doubt where the real insanity lies. In The Full Catastrophe by Michael Weller, a linguist is asked to take on the role of an ad hoc psychologist, or, more accurately, marriage counselor. The play is adapted from a 1990 novel by David Carkeet, part of a trilogy about the linguist, whose name is Jeremy Cook. In The Full Catastrophe, Jeremy takes a peculiar job that requires him to move in with a married couple to help resolve communications issues that threaten their marriage. The well-to-do couple's problems, however, are banal and undramatic, and the upbeat conclusion, which also involves Jeremy's relationship with an old flame, feels forced. The final play in this summer's festival is the only one that's had a previous production. All of the others are world premieres. Sheila Callahan's Everything You Touch is partly a condemnation of the New York fashion world in the mid-70s, and partly a look at the failed modern-day relationships between a fashion designer and his first muse and a mother and daughter. A link between these troubled relationships eventually reveals itself, but the human connections get lost in director May Adralis's excessive interpretation of the play's eccentric stage directions. Stage directions, for example, that call for actors to serve as furniture. A certain degree of excess may reinforce the notions that society increasingly objectifies people, and that an emphasis on trappings and appearances has obscured the most basic human interactions between man and woman, mother and child. Callahan's writing is imaginative and original, but what comes across here is busy, convoluted, and ultimately incongruously sentimental. Traditionally, happy endings have been a rarity at the hard-hitting repertory festival in Shepherdstown. But as it celebrates its 25th year, the Contemporary American Theater Festival is clearly in a positive place.
You can catch the Contemporary American Theater Festival at Sheppard University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, until August 2nd. Shepherdstown is about 90 minutes west of Baltimore and only 30 minutes west of Frederick. Complete details on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more coming up. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Now we're going to meet a couple of the 80 young people who have summer jobs as artist apprentices in Sandtown in West Baltimore. It's called Art at Work Sandtown. It's an offshoot of Jubilee Arts year-round art programs for teens. This particular effort connects young people aged 14 to 21 with master teaching artists to create 7 highly visible murals in their community, plus a mosaic. And with us to talk about the 5-week program and its progress is one of the program's teaching artists, Megan Lewis. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us are two of the artist apprentices, Eric Hendricks is 18 and lives in the Monroe neighborhood. He attended Frederick Douglass School. Welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
And also with us is Talia England. She's 14. She lives in Sandtown and graduated from Collington Square Middle School. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, Megan Lewis, describe the Art at Work program for us.
Of course. The Art at Work program is Julie B. Arts teaming up with the Baltimore Office of Promotion of the Arts. And they've taken 80 young people and team them up with 8 masterclass artists. And we're doing murals throughout the Sandtown community.
Okay, so you've got 80 students. And what are they supposed to produce?
They're supposed to produce 7 murals and 1 mosaic throughout Sandtown.
And who has the idea for what those murals and that mosaic is going to be?
The artists. We had to interview residents. Literally, we were knocking on residents' doors, asking them what do they want to see on the mural. So we had the residents, we had our own personal interests, and we had the owners of the property. So everyone had to, you know, I want this, I don't want this. And we put it all together to create this beautiful mural.
Eric Hendricks, tell me about that process. What was that like, talking to people about, how do you think of a mural?
It made me feel like just going out and asking people. I like that we got their idea, so we don't want to put something on the wall so people don't like it. Or it's good to hear somebody's ideas for the mural.
Talia, what was that process for you like, talking to people?
It scared me a little, because knowing that it's people that I don't know personally, it kind of scared me, because we approaching them, who knows what response we'll get. Like, we can get like a very mean, but most people that we interviewed, they were nice, and we got really good ideas off of them, and we put that together. We did critiques and stuff, and we came up with the ideas for our mural.
So you did critiques. So this, you, after you had talked to some number of people, then you kind of got together and said, what have we learned from most people?
As we walked around interviewing people, we asked them questions. So the questions that, the answer that they gave us, we wrote it down, and we drew out the ideas. We drew out the ideas that they gave us. And then, and we also did our own little sketches of what we wanted, and we put that together. We critiqued, like, we asked our team what did they think about our ideas, and we put that together, and that's how we got our ideas for the mural.
So how are the master teachers part of this process?
Well, each master teacher has their own process in creating a design. Myself, I took them through what I would normally do in order to create a design. First, you know, I collect, you know, information about the piece. I do thumbnails. I look at inspiration. We do color studies. We critique, and then we do the final. And that's exactly the order that I took them through. So when they did the thumbnails, I looked at their thumbnails, and we critiqued it. And when I went home, I put all of their ideas into a single image, because I wind up drawing the final. But I, you know, picked, you know, from every one of the students and compiled like a big, you know, beautiful mural. Or sketch.
On 88.1, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking about the Art at Work program in Sandtown with one of the program's teaching artists, Megan Lewis, and 2 of the students who are working in the project, Eric Hendricks III and Talia England. So you drew these murals, 7 murals and a mosaic?
Well, there's 8. Would you call us master teachers? That's awesome. Thank you. There's 1 mosaic, and there's 7 artists. I'm one of the 7. And each master, can I keep saying master? Because I just love saying it. Master artist, they have 10 students in their group. So each master teacher is responsible for 10 people. And they each did 7 murals in 1 mosaic.
So tell me about the mural that you're working on.
Well, our mural is a picture of an African-American lady with a silhouette of individuals protesting her hair, and she also has a globe floating above her hand that's positioned on Africa, it's a vine coming from the globe with different vegetables hanging from the vine, because the property that we're painting on is owned by a farm, so that's where the vegetables came from. We also have shapes paired in the background, to keep the viewer's eyes moving around our mural and not just on one specific thing, but the whole thing.
Is there a name for this mural?
No, we really don't have.
It's untitled. Yes, we need to name it.
We should name it.
What? What are you thinking?
We have a team name, but we don't think we have the name for it yet.
Yeah, we need to name the actual piece.
I understand part of this program is to give you a chance to learn about careers in art. Tell me about that part of the program.
I feel very passionate about art. It doesn't matter. It hits me. It's like some arts hit me, and I'm not a very emotional person, but I understand like what they're saying in their art and stuff. But it's just like, I really love art and I wish I can continue this. When I got this job, I thought I wouldn't like it. But it's just like, I really, really, like, honestly, 100%, I really like this job. Like, I love coming. I like going home smelling like paint with colors on my hands. I just love working. Like, I can't, it's like I don't want to stop. It's like, I can't stop. You have to continue on what you love. And this basically I love. I don't want to be like, I don't want to be cocky, but I have an A in art.
I can tell. He does awesome work.
How about you, Talia? Have you learned anything in this summer program that you're going to take forward?
Yes, I've learned a lot, actually. Me personally, I've never actually been into art, but when I started this program, like ever since I've been working with Ms. Megan, everything she taught us, like when I moved on to high school, like if I have like an art class and certain students don't know about it, I could teach them. I feel like I can carry on what I have learned in this program to other individuals. Like it's been fun for me. I like what I've learned a lot.
That's like the best compliment I've ever heard in my life.
I think it's great.
Yeah.
I'm really grateful to all of you for talking to us. Thank you so much.
Of course.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Eric Hendricks III is 18, lives in the Monroe neighborhood. He will attend Augusta Fells School in the fall. Talia England is 14. She lives in Sandtown and will attend NAF High School, National Academy Foundation. Megan Lewis, their master teacher, is in charge of their team. We've got more information on our website, including pictures of the students working on the murals. It's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Kast. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Kast. On this day in history, 1877, the strike against pay cuts by the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad spread to Cumberland, Maryland. After Maryland's governor called out the National Guard, violent street battles erupted in Baltimore. At least 10 were killed by militia fire. Dozens on both sides were injured. President Rutherford B. Hayes sent federal troops to Baltimore to restore order.